97.1 FM Talk. On demand audio. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. The Mark Reardon Show.
Loser, loser, loser.
Witch hunt, scam, hoax.
You're going to literally see the craters on the moon with your own eyes.
My name's Joe Biden. Can't sing, can't dance. Can't do much of anything.
This is the Mark Reardon Show.
Hey, how's everyone doing here this afternoon? I got to adjust a couple of different levels. Now I know why Brad was doing what he did in the previous show, because things are a little different right now in the studio. Hi, Sue. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? Welcome back.
I don't know. I'll figure it out here in the next few minutes. I got to figure things out because it's all just a little different. I was here last on Wednesday. I took a couple of days off. I should have taken the whole damn week off last week to avoid frustration, but I didn't. But I did have a couple of good days off. Right now, it sounds like the ocean is in my ear. Does anyone else hear the ocean?
I got a little bit of that.
Why is the ocean in my ear
now? Well, it's better than the high-pitched sound they said we might have, so we'll just take the ocean.
I don't even know what I'm hearing. I really... Yeah, it does sound like the ocean, doesn't it?
Let's take it with ocean instead of traffic, because it could sound
traffic. Maybe it's just the rain that's outside right now. We'll have to figure it out. I was told that Thursday and Friday there were some challenges, so I'll just kind of roll with the ocean here and get going. And unfortunately, I have to start with some news that's not so great. And this has gone national again here for St. Louis, and I was wondering how long it would take, and unfortunately it didn't take very long at all. We have a dead police officer here in St. Louis, and it's very sad because now you have another situation where a Honduran national is responsible for this. And Jane Duker's on the line, which is why I think I hear the ocean. Jane, I think I hear it. Jane, are you there?
I am.
Can you guys hear her right now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Here's what's weird about that. Where Jane is supposed to be coming through on the board, that's not even turned up right now. So we're going to have to figure that out because that's weird. But we'll just have to figure out some things because we changed the studio, Jane. But let me ask you what you know about this particular situation. I know there was a news conference earlier today.
Yeah, the background is that he was responding to an accident. An off-duty firefighter from Ferguson was in an accident, and he was getting ready to set the scene. He was getting the cones out, and he was hit by a car, and he was pinned between two vehicles and then thrown, and they took him to the hospital, but he died from his injuries yesterday. And this was at about 8:30, 9 a.m. in the morning. They determined that the driver was impaired, and now they got toxicology back, and he was legally drunk. The gentleman who killed Officer David Lee, who was an 18-year veteran, two children, wife, by all accounts, I mean, just incredibly popular. People really like him. Hard worker, great guy, always wanted to serve. But anyway, the gentleman who killed him, the person who killed him, wasn't illegal. He was arrested in 2020 in St. Charles, and he tried to strangle. I don't know if it's the mother of his child or a mother of a child. It's not clear from the probable cause statement. But
yeah, when that happened, like he actually punched a woman, he strangled her, and then he took a baby and drove away with the baby, right?
Correct, and then tried to hit the woman with his car and was drunk the entire time. And at that time, he was 20. So, he wasn't even of age to drink. And so he was prosecuted. But in the probable cause statement for that 2020 arrest, it indicated, one, that he was illegal, two, that he was out on bond for entering the country illegally, and another alcohol-related offense that occurred prior to his 20th birthday. The other, I think, interesting thing in the probable cause statement was it specifically indicated that he had no family members except in Honduras. So he had no support system, he just came here on his own. And so he was 20 years old. Well, he was put on probation for both the domestic assault and for the DWI. He's off of the probation for the DWI, but he's still on probation for the domestic assault. And when this happened yesterday. And so this is he's 22 years old, and it's his third alcohol-related offense.
I have 24 years old. Is there a chance he's 24 and not 22?
Oh, 24. Yeah, you're right. You're correct. That's right. No, 22 is when he pled guilty.
Right.
So I got that number. Yeah, that's when he, and by the way, he pled guilty twice. So, I mean, you know, this guy has a pretty good record before any of this even happens. What's also strange, too, was he was able to hire private counsel. He had a lawyer that was not a public defender.
Yeah, that's odd. So, what do you make of that?
Well, I don't know how you afford a criminal defense attorney. I mean, you know, maybe he had a good job. I have no idea. I don't know about his employment history or anything about that. And so it's just very enraging because he should not have been here. He got here, I think, in 2017. Then he committed crimes in 2020. He pled in 2022. And here we are in 2024. And he's killed a police officer.
And by the way, you may mention this, Jim, but he didn't even have a driver's license. I mean, he's not able to get a driver's license.
No, he can't.
Right.
Can't have a driver's license.
Driving, of course.
Can't have a driver's license.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know some people would say, and this is where your site gets involved, some people would say, well, look, we have to give these migrants driver's license because then we have ways to track them and you know, stay on top of them. I don't know what the answer is. All I know is that this is another
CaseNet track of them. Because he was a criminal defendant.
Right, not too difficult.
They were tracking him. He was this is the thing. We're spending money for him to go through, you know, to be housed when he's in jail. And he went through the probation system. That cost taxpayers money. I don't understand how you don't just deport them. I mean, that's easy. I mean, deporting the criminals is the easy discussion. That's the one thing that, like, I can't imagine really people don't agree on.
Yeah, I don't know. Fred, do you know, was that asked because there was a news conference with Gabe Gore and the chief of police. I'm going to play a little audio, but that's a fascinating question. We're going to see if we can track mm-hmm. that down, Jane. But thanks for the latest here this afternoon. I know you and I were both off on the roundtable, so I will see you this Friday for sure.
You got it.
All right, take care. That's Jane Duker, who represents the police officers here in the city of St. Louis. And it's just another horrible thing that happened. Let me play a little bit of the audio here. Here's Chief Tracy earlier today.
24-year-old Ramon Chavez Rodriguez has been charged. DWI, death of a law enforcement officer or emergency personnel, which is a Class B felony. Exceeded posted speed limit, exceeded by 16 to 19 miles per hour over the posted speed limit. Operating a vehicle on a highway without a valid license. This suspect's immigration status is being handled by our federal partners, but my top priority is ensuring justice is served for my officer who was killed.
Our federal partners. What are our federal partners actually doing? That's what I'd like to know, because we do have a dead police officer here in St. Louis. And obviously this could happen when someone's immigration status is not in question, but that's not what's happening here. And it's a great question about why you can't just have someone that commits a crime repeatedly, by the way. Why would that even be questioned? You want to start with mass deportations? Let's start with the criminals that go through our system time and time and time again, right?
24-year-old Ramon Chavez.
Hang on, that's Tracy again. Here's Gabe Gore.
It has no impact on the charges, on the charging decision. It does have an impact on our assessment as to whether or not he's an individual who is a flight risk or poses a danger to the community, and whether or not he's someone who should receive a bond. I have not looked into the immigration issues. I mean, that's not relevant to our charges except for the purposes of considering whether or not he should be granted a bond. My understanding is that he did have a hearing on his immigration status that was set for later this month or later in October. But other than that, I haven't really looked into those issues.
All right, so there you are. And again, this story has gone national throughout a lot of different websites and will continue. I haven't seen it on Fox yet. They've been talking about some other things related to some migrants that have committed crimes. But Fred, have you seen it on Fox
yet? No, Fox News has not reported it
yet. I bet they will, though, now that it's getting some national attention, unfortunately. All right, well, we have a lot of other stuff here to cover this afternoon outside of that. Josh Hammer is going to join us here in just a few minutes, Newsweek senior editor at large. You hear him on the Josh Hammer Show Saturdays at 1 p.m. We'll get into that. Brad Young's going to join us this afternoon. He'll have some things to say about this police officer. Also, the you guys, like, I don't even know how much of this stuff came out late last week because I dialed out. Wednesday I left and played golf on Thursday and basically cleaned my house on Friday. I took a day off to clean my house. That was dumb, but I did it anyway. But some of the stuff that's coming out over the weekend about
this
guy.
New.
And I don't like to mention his name. All right, so the second attempted assassination dude who essentially, and this is what I think a lot of us felt from the beginning when this guy was arrested and he's smiling. He's proud of himself. He is happy that he did it. He's disappointed that he, you know, failed. It's my understanding of this letter that he wrote that's now been kind of uncovered. And this is difficult to navigate because I don't want to give a guy like this attention, you know, to his screed. But he wrote that letter. Is it your understanding that somebody found that in the aftermath of this, but it seemed like he was writing it just in case he was caught? And if he was caught, he said, look, I failed. Is that essentially how it?
It's hard to tell, but I think that's kind of it. And they had it, but it's just nip and now being released.
Right.
Someone had it, and they just turned it over.
Right. So very disturbing things coming out of there, but I want to be a little bit hesitant, and I think that some news outlets are being a little cautious with this because of the potential to just offer a playbook here and to glorify all this stuff. So that's not something that I'm interested in at all. But here's what I am interested in. The state of the race here as we sit on September 23rd, 6 weeks from tomorrow, is the election. Let me draw a little compare and contrast here, ladies and gentlemen. And there's some polling that's... Whoa.
The age-old
battle.
Didn't
even mean to do that. See,
Men.
That's...
versus mole.
No, that's not it. It is not a mole update. Oh. See, that was just me moving a board here, and I'm just trying to get comfortable, and I apologize for that. And I think sometimes things are going to happen like that. Okay, it's September 23rd, 6 weeks from tomorrow. Let me draw, compare, and contrast, as I said. Sue, I don't know how much television you watched over the weekend, over the last 3 days. Did
not
you watch
much.
Any live
much.
Television?
No.
Fred, you said you did, right?
I did.
Okay. Now, I bring it up because I think this is true outside of sports, but we'll see if the audience agrees. I'm sitting around watching a ton of football over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
A ton of football. I went to Mizzou and went to that game, but then on Saturday night we got home because we left a little early. And by the way, I'll cover the fact that Mizzou sucks and should not even be in the top 25, let alone in contention for the college football playoff, a little later in the show. But watching football all day yesterday. Lots of Kamala Harris ads. The ad, yeah. it's an ad that's created by the Obama team. She's smiling. I think they feature a clip that was from the debate where she looked at the camera. Now you can even see more how prepared she was because they wanted to flip what she said in the debate into an ad, which is exactly what she did. But she comes across as, I would even say presidential. You got to look at these things through the lens of someone who is not
dialed
following
in.
This. Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Those of you who are looking at this and you hear me say, oh, you know, this is a good ad. Well, it is a good ad for people who are undecided. You see someone up there who you may have been told is a complete idiot in the media, because she is, who now looks, wow, really glossy, and she looks not as angry as Trump. You know, if you look at the optics, I've been kind of talking about this for a while now. So you have that. You have hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent by the Harris campaign to influence people, independent voters, certainly in these swing states that matter. And on the other side of the equation, you have the former president hawking a coin. I wish I was making this up. Yesterday, he tweets out, hello, everyone. I have something incredible to share today as we are introducing the launch of our official Trump coins, the only official coin designed by me and proudly minted here in the USA. The President Donald J. Trump first edition silver medallion will be available, blah, blah, blah. We're 6 weeks away from what I think, and maybe this is hyperbolic because we do it all the time, is probably the most important election, certainly of my lifetime. And I'm concerned about my young daughter at this point and her future and what that might hold. And you got a guy that's out there hawking coins. I don't get that, Trump folks. I don't get it at all. So I use this as a bit of a cautionary tale because I know what's going to happen here after the election if Harris wins. I'm not saying she's going to win. There are some things going on right now that look pretty good for Trump in the swing states. And we can get into that as the show moves along. But I also know what's going to happen if he loses. There's going to be a bunch of people out there talking about a stolen election. Stolen election this, stolen election that. The Democrats stole it. Let's look back just a little bit on a day like this where we can say, wait a second, we're 6 weeks out from the election and this guy's hawking a coin. Sorry, that does not work for me, ladies and gentlemen. And I think it's a bad, bad move heading into the home stretch. We'll see what happens next. There's going to be some surprises as we get to the end of September and October. Josh Hammer, coming up next. All right, doing our best to get comfortable here. The brand new control board, which makes things a little different than they used to be. The audience doesn't care. That's why my boss would tell me, Mark, stop talking about changes in the studio. But this is my first day back since Wednesday. So you've had to deal with it here for longer than I have.
Yeah.
So we're going to do our best. We got some hiccups, some things that are going on. We're going to get through it. We have, of course, Sue's news in the next hour. I got a bunch of different things because, as you might imagine, since I wasn't here on Thursday and Friday, I've been making some notes to myself. Sue will get all caught up in the next hour. In the 5 o'clock hour tonight, John Ziegler will be here, the co-host of the podcast, The Death of Journalism, good friend from out in California. And then the other thing that I saw a lot on television over the weekend were ads for Winning for Missouri Education, which, a.k.a., was legalized sports wagering. They're spending a ton of money on that campaign, so we're going to get into that in the 5 o'clock hour, plus an audio cut of the day and more. Right now, we welcome back Josh Hammer, Newsweek Senior Editor-at-Large, host of The Josh Hammer Show. You hear it every Saturday, 1 p.m. on 97.1 FM Talk. Josh, how are you this afternoon? Welcome back.
You know, Mark, I'm a little under the weather, but there's no such thing as too under the weather to join you, my friend.
Well, I appreciate that, certainly. And let me start. I want to get your thoughts. I always find it interesting, your thoughts on the election. But let's start with what's going on in, in Lebanon and related to the Israeli conflict. You have 274 people killed in Israeli strikes. You know, Josh, in a weird way, there's some of this, and I wasn't paying as close attention. But I started reading newscasts and, you know, doing things on the radio in the 1980s when bombings of Lebanon were very common. It's almost bringing me back to that point at this point where, you know, you have so much going on over there. And now, let me say this, it's almost like people in this country are kind of tuned out a little bit because of everything going on here with the election.
So the media and the political class more generally, Mark, for the past year have overwhelmingly focused in Gaza and the threat from Hamas.
Right.
But it was the world's worst-kept secret for those in the know that the real threat, the real danger, was actually coming from Israel's north, from Hezbollah. Hezbollah has over 100,000 precision-guided missiles in their arsenal. They are orders of magnitude better armed. They are orders of magnitude more sophisticated than Hamas. Unlike Hamas, which receives funds from Iran, from Qatar, and various other rogue actors, Hezbollah is a straight-up Iranian proxy. So they have extraordinarily close ties with Iran. Hassan Nasrallah, who's the head of Hezbollah, is very chummy with the Ayatollah in Tehran and so forth there. But, you know, I think the most important fact for the listeners to bear in mind here, because you're going to have all the usual suspects, the left-wing idiots who are going to be saying, oh, Israel's trying to start another war here. Well, the reality is that Hezbollah has rained roughly 8,500 rockets, missiles, and drones on Israeli civilians since October 8th, literally the day after the Hamas massacre in the Gaza envelope. You know, when I was over there in January, which is the last time I was over there, all the Israelis I spoke to were talking to me as if the situation in Gaza, they'll figure it out. I mean, they will reach some situation there. But the real problem was that 60 to 80,000 Israelis living in the north, in the Sea of Galilee region, in the Golan Heights region, they've been displaced. I mean, they have not been living in their homes for almost a year now. And, you know, look, I don't think it's going to reach a full-scale Israeli tanks start rolling in ground war. I could be wrong about that. I could definitely be wrong about that. I am thinking that Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, is probably going to stand down. But before that, I don't think that he wants a war just as much as Israel does not want a war right now. I mean, Israel has taken out some very, very, very top Hezbollah commanders just over the past week. They took out Ibrahim Akil on Friday. This is a man who the FBI had a $7 million bounty on his head because he was instrumental in the 1983 bombings of the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. Marines barracks in Beirut, which slaughtered 241 U.S. Marines. Israel took him out on Friday. They took out multiple other high-profile commanders over the weekend and Monday. So I'm thinking here that Hezbollah is more likely than not to not risk the actual tanks rolling in a third full-scale Israel-Lebanon war, but I could be wrong about that.
What you mentioned that I want to focus a little bit on the northern communities because the geography, I think, is a little tough for people who are not paying attention to this. And just the information that 60,000 Israelis have been displaced because of the threats from Hezbollah, I think a lot of people would be surprised by that because that's an undercovered aspect of this story, as we sort of indicated, isn't it, Josh?
You know, people don't talk about it, Mark. It's pretty crazy. But I can actually, you know, I can be a little personal with you. So, my wife, who is – born in Israel. She was raised mostly here, but most of her family is still over there. So the Jewish holidays start in a little over a week. We have our New Year, Rosh Hashanah, which starts a week from Wednesday. And my wife's, I guess it's her cousin, and then her first cousin once removed, technically. They're planning to fly over here later this week, but they're flying over from a town in the Israeli north. That's where they live. It's called Kiryat Atta. Kiryat Atta has been directly targeted by Hezbollah. I mean, the Iron Dome missile defense just over the past week has been going off every few minutes, seemingly. And, you know, the question right now in our family, in our extended family, is whether or not they're even going to be able to make it. In fact, her son actually just had his bar mitzvah a few months ago. This is going to be his big bar mitzvah gift to come over to America for the first time, see Florida, see New York. So we're kind of on pins and needles to see whether that whole situation plays out. But, you know, that's just kind of adding a little bit of a personal element here. You have 60 to 80,000 Israelis who are not there. And when you zoom out, Mark, and think about what the Iranian regime's long-term goal is, you know, it's not necessarily a single Hiroshima-Nagasaki-style strike. It's death by a thousand cuts. They view this as a war of attrition, where you essentially break down the Israeli psyche with massacres like what Hamas did on October 7th, with the massacre that Hezbollah was planning on doing in the Israeli north as recently as last week before Israel launched the pager walkie-talkie operation and amped up their game. They got intel that Hezbollah is planning something very similar. They want the Israelis to retreat and recede from their borders inch by inch by inch. That is the way that they ultimately hope to get to Jerusalem and finish it off.
Meantime, in another conflict across the planet, is it just me, or is Zelensky coming to this country to campaign for Harrison Biden, essentially?
It certainly seems that way. I mean, signing the whole, you know, the missile with Josh Shapiro earlier today in the munitions factory in Pennsylvania. You know, another friend pointed out to me that the optics of this are a little odd, isn't it? Is that Donald Trump, you know, the world has moved on, but Donald Trump had a second attempted assassination 8 days ago, I guess it was, on my math. And, you know, among the causes that he was associated with, probably the number one cause, was that he was over-the-top zealous for the Ukrainian cause. I mean, he literally flew there trying to recruit Afghans to go fight for Ukraine. He was trying to kind of shepherd them in through Iran to fight the Russians on the Ukraine's behalf. He was saying all of the various pro-Ukraine platitudes and whatnot there. And I think the optics are just a little weird that the opposition party is now openly appearing on the stump with Zelensky, the guy who tried to kill Trump, was in turn going over the top to do all of his various deeds for. Now, I am not impugning everyone who is ardently pro-Ukraine. That's definitely not what I'm saying. But I do think the optics of this are a little weird, and it's definitely unprofessional at the least. It is disgraceful, you might say, at the most, for a foreign leader to try to get involved here at a time like this. I mean, to kind of compare real briefly, I mean, you know, Bibi Netanyahu would obviously prefer that Donald Trump win this election. That's not exactly a well-kept secret, but he would never appear on the campaign trail.
Right. Yeah, it's weird. It's definitely weird. There's no doubt about that. Let me just get your thoughts on the overall state of the race. Here we are, 6 weeks away from the election. Here's some news that I haven't shared with the audience. I don't know if this is positive or not, but there's a cookie poll that they do in Cincinnati, and that poll has predicted every election except for the last one since 1984. Trump's leading in the cookie poll. He's got some other polls that are somewhat encouraging on this Monday in swing states, but then I also went off on the fact that we're 6 weeks out and he's hawking mint coins on his social media instead of focusing on the campaign, Josh.
Yeah, I saw that, and, you know, I roll my eyes basically through the back of my head.
Me too.
Presumably there are things that are better worth Donald Trump's time than that. There's really just no other way to say it. I don't really know what else to say. I mean, what a bizarre thing to do. But, I mean, having said that, Mark, I actually think that Donald Trump is in decent shape right now. I really do think that if the election were held tomorrow, that he would win. I do not claim super high confidence in that. My confidence level is probably around 65%, so I am not overwhelmingly going to bet the ranch on it or anything. But if you look at the highest quality pollsters, New York Times Siena College poll comes to mind, they do show Trump up or right there, like within 1 point at the very most, within the margin of error in essentially all of these states.
Yeah,
Pennsylvania is the biggest state, Mark. I mean, Pennsylvania essentially could single-handedly determine the election right now. I think that you have to think that in a state like Pennsylvania, all of the late-breaking undecided voters end up voting against the incumbent party. That's usually what happens in a presidential election cycle. The white working class vote, if Donald Trump can get back to those 2016 margins even slightly, because those margins have actually come down a little bit. But if he can focus on the white working class there, his bread and butter in Pennsylvania, I think he's in good shape.
You know, I'm going to share this with the audience a little bit, but there was a focus group that came out of Pennsylvania with African-American undecideds in theory. And I was really struck by the fact that they were some of them were very suspicious about, and they should be, the quality and the caliber of Kamala Harris's leadership. In other words, they said that she looked weak, which I think she does. But it was interesting that that kind of bled through to that focus group, Josh.
So, you know, the young black men demographic is actually very interesting this cycle. I mean, you have upwards of 25% in some polls breaking for Trump. I mean, that would be historical numbers. For a Republican candidate. You know, more generally, a lot of these focus groups, especially in the aftermath of that debate, you know, the Kamala Trump debate, that the media immediately clamored in unison that Kamala Harris wiped the floor with him. But all the focus groups that were polled, you know, they were not so certain.
I know.
There was a New York Times focus group. There was a Reuters focus group. A plurality, if not majority of them, all said that Donald Trump won that debate. So I think the media are ahead of their skis. I think Kamala Harris's popularity, her favorabilities have probably peaked at this point. I really think over the next month and a half, it's going to start to tilt incrementally, but on a day-in, day-out basis towards Trump.
All right. I love the optimism, Hammer. We'll hear you on Saturdays at 1 p.m., the Josh Hammer Show, every Saturday afternoon right here on 97.1 FM Talk. Josh, appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Talk soon, Mark. Thank you.
Okay, operator error there. Still trying to get used to some buttons, and Ethan's in here telling me what I did wrong, so I'm going to try. Sue Thomas is in the studio. We've got Sue's news in the next hour here on 97.1 FM Talk. Let me get to the focus group. I think I stated before the break when we were talking with Josh that this was Pennsylvania voters. It's not. These are voters in Georgia, African-American voters in Georgia. But I think it's pretty, you know, pretty on point to what you would probably see in Pennsylvania, although maybe just a different demographic with working-class people. But every time I see a focus group with people asked about this, black people in particular, about the presidential race, they're very suspicious of Kamala Harris. And they should be. Don't get me wrong. But I find it interesting. So here's a little bit of a sample from this group in Georgia.
Hand up if you think the economy is better under Trump. And hands up if you think the economy is better under Biden and Harris.
All right. He'll give you the math.
Okay. 7-1. That's pretty clear.
Yeah. So in case you're math challenged, which I am, there were eight people and there was one dude that raised his hand for Kamala Harris. The rest of them said, nope, probably not. And they went into some details here with this particular interviewer on the focus group.
I'm not saying he's like, of course, yeah, like I dare say, he has best. He still has a business mindset. I think that lended somewhat. And I think, yes, the trickle down of whatever previous stuff. And I think he just handles certain things a little better.
She's talking about Trump.
Who does?
Trump.
Then?
He provided more jobs, more opportunities, stimulus. Even though he didn't have any experience in politics, but he came in and did a much better job. If you look at the statistics now, we're far more worse now.
So those are just real people. Those are not pundits. Those
Very
are not insiders. Those are black voters in Georgia being asked questions about each of these candidates and what they like about them and what they might not like about them. And then, you know, maybe some distrust issues as well. I think this is, let me see if this is the bite on leadership here.
Mikhail, how about you?
Everything that glitters ain't gold.
No, I like this. So let me lead this a little bit better. So, you know, I think that the question is sort of focused here on, you know, what's your feeling about Kamala Harris and why are you sort of leaning against her? And she focuses on the style of her substance, really.
Mikhail, how about you?
Everything that glitters ain't gold.
Yeah, for sure.
Very, it looks great on paper. But I'm not sure it could translate to politics and if she'll even be able to get it passed.
Hey, what?
My thing is her strength. That's my focus with her. You know, is she going to be able to take a punch and give one or two back? You know, that's my biggest thing. and it has nothing to do with her gender, ladies. No.
Yeah, he was surrounded by a bunch of women, and he wanted to make sure that he was being very careful
right.
there. But, you know, that's echoed here. I got one more bite. But he was focusing in on, and a couple of those voters were focusing in on, wait a second, does she have the strength, the courage to make tough decisions on the world stage? And they don't feel that from this particular candidate. They're accurate. Of course, yep. we know that. That's the right feeling. But to me, it's interesting that it's bleeding through to African-American voters.
You can't be weak and hold that over.
Yeah, like if you put her next to Michelle Obama, it's like...
Or Hillary Clinton.
Or Hillary Clinton. It's like it's no comparison on the strength that I think Michelle Obama or Hillary Clinton would have against her. They would eat her up.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Wow.
You know, and they, by the way, they all agreed. You know, that's an interesting comparison. Of course, Michelle Obama's name was mentioned as the savior to ride in. And I think everybody knew two things, that she wasn't going to do it. But if she did do it, she would have smoked Trump and she would have won the election hands down. And, you know, you kind of heard, you know, they even said nicer things about Hillary Clinton than they did Kamala Harris. So that's fascinating to me as well. And these are real things that people are going to react to and make their decisions on. Now, let me kind of segue this into, I love hearing real people, and you don't hear real people enough. It shouldn't just be real focus groups where you hear real people. And I want to mention something here about a comment I read this morning from my friend Bernie Goldberg. Bernie wrote a book many years ago called Bias about the media. He worked at CBS News. He blogs these days. He used to be a regular guest on the show. He's kind of off into his podcast world right now. But one of the people that I always mention and I miss terribly is this guy, Tim Russert. Used to host Meet the Press when it was good on NBC News every Sunday.
Good morning and welcome to Meet the Press. If I told you it was 25% of your state live below the poverty line, would you believe me?
I could believe it, yes.
Are these the kinds of things a governor should know? Who the largest employers are? How many people live below the poverty line?
You hear the intensity there?
Yeah.
He actually...
You said that part of your $40 billion deficit is $180 billion.
Yes, may I finish?
May I finish? It was a simple question. Please.
Yeah, so he held people's feet to the fire all the time. And I've said this so many times, I miss Tim Russert. I miss Tim Russert. Here I am on a Monday. I open up my computer. I see Bernie talking about an interview that he did with Tim Russert from... And Tim, by the way, for people who don't know, Tim Russert died in June of 2008. He had a heart attack. It was a complete surprise. And everything changed in journalism, I think. Now, Tim Russert also worked, I don't know if you know this or how many people know this, he worked for a Democrat. Democrat Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a loud, boisterous New York senator. And I think still pretty left-wing, even by today's standards, right? This is when Democrats used to represent working class people. So Bernie sat down with Tim Russert and asked him some questions about journalism, which I thought were fascinating. And they go along the lines of some of the things that I say. I've said this before. Some of you know this. Why in the world wouldn't the New York Times or the Washington Post or NBC or ABC, why wouldn't they have a bureau? We used to have news bureaus here in the middle of the country. Talk to real people in Missouri or in Oklahoma or in Kentucky.
I don't think they care.
So they don't care. But Bernie asked Tim Russert about fair journalism, and he says this: the key to fair journalism was always respecting another person's views and never suggesting that anyone had a monopoly on correctness. And that should be the centerpiece of being a journalist. You don't get to go out there bringing your profession an attitude that you know what is right for the country, or you know what is a view or a progressive one or the appropriate one to have. Now, just take that in and of itself. That is the exact opposite. The complete opposite of where journalism is today. So Bernie asks him this question. Again, this goes back to the early 2000s when he's asking these questions. He says, does your blue-collar radar detect an elitism even amongst your colleagues? Sure, Russert says. Some, among politicians, among journalists, it exists. This is great right now, what he says. I am all for having women in the newsroom and minorities in the newsroom. I'm all for that. But just as well, let's have people with military experience. Let's have people from all walks of life, people from top-tiered echelon schools, but also from junior colleges and so-called middling schools. That's the rich pageantry of America, Tim Russert said. He's right about that. Another question. Tim, you seem to be a real proponent of diversity. You believe in it when it comes to race and gender because it's better to have lots of people with different points of view. I'm a great believer in racial diversity and gender diversity, but you need cultural diversity. You need ideological diversity. You need it. We don't have that at all.
Nope.
Question. Why the closed-mindedness when the subject comes around to media bias? There are a whole bunch of people in the world of journalism and the world of academia who just shut the discussion down. Russert. That, to me, is totally contrary to who we're supposed to be as journalists. My view was invite Bernie Goldberg and Bias on my show. That's central to who we are. Let's talk about it. The rest of the mainstream media, I mean, Bernie Goldberg should have been featured on CBS 60 Minutes to talk about media bias, but of course, he was writing about them, so he couldn't be. But it is kind of amazing when you look back to this. And, you know, when Bernie wrote an op-ed in 1996 that was in the Wall Street Journal, Russert says, the first person I talked to that morning was Tom Brokaw. And I feel like people need to know who Tom Brokaw is, though. He was a legendary anchor for NBC News for a long time. And he says, did you see the piece? And he said, I sure did. I told them that I was going to give it out down here in Washington. I talked to people about it. I said, we've got to engage on this issue. It's imperative that we talk about this issue. If someone suggested that there was anti-black bias, that there was anti-gay bias, anti-American bias, we'd sit up and say, let's talk about this. Let's tackle it. Well, if there's liberal bias or cultural bias, we have to sit up, tackle it, and discuss it. We've got to do these things. No one's ever done them, right? I miss Tim Russert so dearly. He was right about all this stuff.
Get more at 971talk.com.